The unique parental identity struggle of an embryo adoption dad. That is what we're talking about today on the Embryo Adoption Podcast, brought to you by the National Embryo Donation Center. You can learn more about us at embryodonation.org. I'm your host, Mark Mellinger, and Derek King, an NEDC dad, is my guest today. He and his wife, Bethany, have two kids through embryo adoption with the NEDC, Lewis and Iona. And so good to have you here, Derek. And as you and I were talking not long ago, as an embryo adoption dad, you wrestled at first with the fact that you're the one person involved in the process who wouldn't have a biological or genetic connection to your kids. So let's start there. What feelings does that bring up for an embryo adoption dad? What did it bring up for you?
That's a good question, Mark, and thanks for having me on. This is you all have meant a lot to us, and so I'm glad to be on here, and I'm excited to talk with you today. It was something I don't know if I felt. It wasn't in a moment. It didn't hit me all at once, but something that kind of unfolded over the last few years of recognizing that there is something different in the way we're able to relate to our children. And it's something that I'm extremely grateful for. And so I hope that no one hears me complaining about this, that my wife has this, you know, kind of unique biological bond with our children. I love that. And that was one of the things that drew us to embryo adoption in the first place as well. It's something that we were really excited about. But it's just something that's, as I've kind of reflected on it, recognizing that my relationship to our children is different in a very, it's a small way. And of course the relationship is the same. I feel as much their dad as I'm sure Bethany does their mom, but yeah, especially comparing it to more typical adoption stories that where both parents are kind of in the same boat, they probably feel the same about their relationship, maybe have some of those same insecurities. Whereas, you know, Bethany carried our children in her womb like any other normal pregnancy. People around us saw her doing that. And there's that just that kind of little edge to it that being an embryo adoptive father, you don't have any role really. It feels almost like a spectator at times. And of course, just in ways that babies typically are made, dads are almost only spectators anyway. But yeah, I just kind of felt that a little bit more, is that I really have, the only thing I can do is support my wife. And it just kind of, I just felt that a little bit. I felt that tension, but overall, I'm still like just thrilled over the moon that Bethany is able to have that kind of relation, to have that relationship with our children, even though I don't share in it.
Well, and I'm interested in knowing, how did you, and you've written, and I'm glad you've written this because it's absolutely the truth. You've written, hey, I am their real dad. This is not a hoax. And what you just said is absolutely correct. I mean, my kids are biologically mine, and I didn't have much to do with that 9 months of pregnancy. I totally agree with that. So trust me, yeah, an embryo adoption dad isn't doing hardly any less than other dads. So yeah, you're absolutely right about that. How did you start to get to the point though, Derek, where parental identity wasn't such a fragile thing anymore?
Yeah, good. It's something that any adoptive parent has to work through to some extent. And as you, even just preparing for adoption, and adoption was something that my wife and I had talked about very early on. I think even before we were married, we had talked about this being in our future and wanting to do this at some point. So even just that always being in the background of our minds, you already kind of start to work out what that would be like, what that would feel like, especially if you already had biological children, which my wife and I did not. But if you already had biological children, would it feel different? And I think there's that question. And but the answer, as I kind of landed, was it seems really clear to me that being a parent is really about the relationship itself more than any genetic material that you're able to provide, or even biological connection. And I think we all intuitively feel that and get that when we see other parents that have adopted children. We recognize that those are their real parents, even though they may have had no role in the biology or in the child, coming into life. But, and I don't want to downplay or discount the genetic, the importance of the genetic family and of that kind of traditional way that families come about. I do think that's very important, and very important for a lot of reasons, including for like the Christian sexual ethic and many other reasons we could say as well. And the, even the connection that there is a kind of biological bond between parents and children. But I think the relational bond is just so much stronger and so much more important. And that's what I came to kind of grasp onto, I guess, and recognize this is what it means to be a father to my children, is how am I relating to them? Not did I have some role in their biology or genetics?
And this is not just common sense truth, or not just one of those things that is plainly evident as you study humanity, although I think those are proof texts for it, and I totally agree with what you said. But this is also something that is theologically true, and I'm interested in talking with you about that, about what in God's economy makes someone a father. You have studied this at some length, and it's interesting. You were able to dig into scripture and see the similarities between dads like you and Jesus's earthly father, Joseph, to kind of come to this theological understanding of what makes someone a father in God's economy. Can you unpack sort of the high points of that?
Sure, happy to. I'll say, first of all, I kind of stumbled into thinking about this. It wasn't something that I set out to do, to connect my story to theology or to my work. I should say, a theologian. So I'm trained in theology. I did my PhD in theology. And so I sometimes just can't help but see things in a kind of theological light. And it actually happened, and I don't draw any special significance out of this, whatever, I guess, but I suppose it could be significant that this insight, I guess, came from a time of prayer and a time of just kind of a regular morning practice of, you know, kind of the traditional quiet time. And part of that time was reading through the Apostles' Creed, which is something, again, I'd done several times, as I mentioned in the Christianity Today article, and noticing how it talked about Jesus's birth and conception, just kind of struck me as I was reading it, that it almost sounded, how it was being described almost sounded like embryo adoption. And I just thought, and of course, that's also in my mind as well. Now it's hard to hear words like conception or genetics or birth without it seeing it through this lens of embryo adoption, right? And so, yeah, just it kind of got in my mind a little bit to think, is this, in terms of the biology, in terms of the genetics, is this what's going on in Jesus's story, which is also very, you know, unique. And that's unique in the real sense of it. There's never been another case exactly like this one. I started to dig into that a little bit more. It's not something I'd ever studied personally to that point. And so I did have some friends. So Amy Piller, who's a pastor in Wheaton, and she's a professor at Wheaton as well, of New Testament. I just kind of reached out to her and started this dialogue about what, so I know you've studied, she'd studied Mary a lot and had studied the story. And she, you know, she was like, yeah, well, the tradition does say that, like, it's really important for Mary to have supplied the egg, and that there's this genetic material that she's passing along. And the more I just kind of reflected on that, the more I thought, yeah, so there is, like, thinking about trying to put myself in kind of Joseph's shoes now, of he also, it's almost like he's a spectator. And so even though the story of Jesus's conception may not mirror embryo adoption, and that I think that Mary did have some role to play, genetic, biological role to play in Jesus's birth, that my story still lined up with Joseph's really closely, and that there is this kind of spectator element, or you might feel the spectator element on the dad side, that hey, I really didn't have any role in this whatsoever. And this child is not related to me in the same sense, in the exact same sense that the child is related to my wife. And so I just started, and the Gospels don't give us a whole lot of insight into that. And so a lot of it is, I guess, speculation, but they do still give us some clues, I think, about how Joseph saw his relationship to his son. And yeah, as an embryo adoptive dad, I found comfort in that and found this significant.
And the reason that Joseph was Jesus's real dad is what in God's eyes did you determine make someone a father? I mean, you've said it already, but expand on that a little bit more. I think it's a good point to underscore.
Yeah, absolutely. It is that relational component that it's really God ordained in a very overt way, right? In the Jesus story, but in the story of every embryo adoption, there's a God ordained relationship there. And I won't give the whole quote because it's a long quote and I don't have it memorized anyway, but in the Christianity Today article, I give this quote from John Chrysostom, who's talking about the relationship between Joseph and Jesus. And he really just hits this point home really hard and really well, I think, that there is this kind of God giving this gift to Joseph of being a dad, of being Jesus's parent. And he plays this role in Jesus's life and this really special and unique role. And I'd also read this book on parenting, which is a great book on parenting. He's an academic philosopher, but he's writing at a really accessible level. Michael Austin has this book called Wise Stewards, and I quote him in the article as well. And the point that he kind of makes, he makes a really similar point in that we often use language of ownership to talk about our children. And that's just almost unavoidable. And I just did it right there, right? Our children,
my
child. Yeah. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. But he does point out that there can be some problems with thinking about being a parent in terms of ownership. And we should rather think of it in terms of stewardship, is that my child isn't mine. I don't own him, right? Or I don't own her. But God has given us these children to steward them into adulthood and to teach them how to be people of faith, to teach them how to love Jesus. So we have these like roles that we play. And again, they're God ordained, God given. And that's true whether there's a kind of typical biological birth or whether it's embryo adoption or other forms of adoption or even fostering. I had a foster parent reach out to me after the article came out. And I think there's a lot of connections with fostering as well. But I think that the key component here is that we're all stewards, and we've all been kind of given these children by God to steward them like we steward our other resources, right? That we don't see them as our own, that I can just do whatever I want with this child, but I have certain responsibilities to bring him and her up in the faith. And that's really what it means to be a father and a mother.
Yeah, responsible yeah. Stewardship and standing in close relation and thanking God for the gift that these children are and remembering that, like everything, they're all on loan. Nothing's really ours, right?
Exactly. We leave the earth the same way we come in, right? And that's with nothing and only just going back to God. And I think that there is something significant in that. And yeah, that's right. The importance of the relationship. And this is, again, what we all kind of intuitively recognize, that it's the relationship that really makes us a father and a mother. And a father or mother, a parent that abandons their child is not playing that role. It's not being a mother or father in the child's life, regardless of what role they might have played, some biological or genetic role.
And you have alluded to it a couple of times, and I wanted to get to this, that you were able to write about all of this in a recent issue of Christianity Today. In fact, that's actually what sparked the idea for this podcast episode, because I thought the article was so good, and we shared it also on our NEDC social media. And I'm telling you, lots and lots of people, I think it was over 120 at last count, have clicked on the article from there, and obviously thousands upon thousands read it in NCT, either online or in the print version of the magazine. So a couple things on that. first of all, I'm so glad God put you in a position to serve others in this way. Derek, how did that come about? And what is the general response to the article been like? It's been out for a little bit now.
Yeah, good. It kind of came about. I didn't plan it. I didn't set out to, I haven't been writing this over the last several years or anything like this. It is almost like, again, as kind of a theologian by day, that's kind of my day job, I guess, is it's hard to not think about things through a theological lens. And just throughout the whole process of embryo adoption over the last several years, when we first really turned towards this and started, I guess, aggressively pursuing this route, which by the way, kind of coincided with the beginning of COVID, to give you kind of a timeline of like, is when we were really like, okay, we're doing this, we're locked in, we're doing embryo adoption. So over these last few years, that's just been something that's kind of been on my mind, not often explicitly, but just kind of rattling around in the background of thinking about this through a theological lens. And it did all kind of click together with the Joseph story over the last year, especially. And so, yeah, I thought I would like to write on this and just kind of tell our story, not just doing theology, but that's something that's almost, I guess, it put me out of my comfort zone a little bit, that I'm used to just writing about God or about scripture, about the theological tradition, and not telling my own story. And so it was really a blessing to do that, and something I really enjoyed, to think about how these things actually overlap of what God's doing in our life, and then how we can see something like the Jesus story as providing a special comfort for us. So yeah, I wrote it up, and the response has been really good so far. I mean, several people have reached out via email that, of course, I had not met before. And then a lot of people in my circle as well. What was kind of, I don't know, funny about it, but a lot of people in my circle didn't know my story and didn't know that we had adopted embryos, not because we are hiding it, just because, you know, it just doesn't organically come up, right, in normal conversations. So we've heard several people say, oh, wow, I didn't know this was part of your story. Like, I know someone who's considering embryo adoption. I sent the article to them. And again, that's just like so encouraging to hear that, it's going to other people who are considering embryo adoption, and that just even in our kind of little community, that it's having that kind of impact. And so, yeah, it's been really encouraging.
That's great to hear, because I really thought it was a terrific article. Talk about it before we go, a couple last things as we go back to when you were sort of sifting through parental identity issues that we've been talking about for most of this episode. I do want you to talk about Bethany, your wife, her role in helping you through this. I mean, it is a unique spot, and you alluded to this earlier, but I think it's worth camping out on for a second. It's unique because, you know, generally in infertility, it's the couple sharing virtually all aspects of the burden together. And this was different because it's a unique part of it, in the sense that it's really only you sharing this particular aspect of the burden. But I would assume your wife was some help in that, and maybe there's a lesson there for otherwise. I don't know. You haven't told me that, but I'm just interested in digging into that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first I would say Bethany, she would have been great on this podcast as well, but with the two kids running around, she's at home right now, we thought, and she doesn't love being in front of people. So she's already cringing that we're talking about her on this podcast. So she's obviously been enormously supportive, as I hope I've been for her. And I, of course, feel I still feel a great imbalance in what she has to go through versus what I have to go through. The physical pain, the toll of all the shots and the pregnancy and all of that. So, I am just trying to support her in any way that I can there. But I mean, her and I have talked about it several times since Lewis was born. We didn't honestly, we didn't know what to expect. And I think a lot of parents, any parents probably feel that. Am I going to feel this immediate connection when I hold my child for the first time, or is it going to take time to develop? As I was talking with my friends, who several of them had already had children, they just all had different stories too of how did that happen? How did that connection happen? We had talked about it several times while Bethany was pregnant, is what is this going to be like, especially because we aren't genetically related to them. So there's not, you know, we might say, oh, he looks like me, or he looks like this is a characteristic like her. We know that connection is not really there. And so is that going to change things? Is it going to feel different? And we've talked about it several times since Lewis was born, that we just often forget that they're not genetically related to us, which again, I think is a great blessing, that it's not something that's on the forefront of our minds. Both of our children just seem to fit so well in our family and with us that it's really hard to imagine any other way, which I kind of mentioned at the end of the article, that it's kind of surprised us both, I think, how we felt about it, how natural it's felt. And so thankfully, yeah, I haven't had like this kind of identity crisis of being a parent hasn't kind of manifested itself like maybe we feared that it could with adopting children. And I don't know if that answers your question, but that's where we kind of are at emotionally now is we don't feel that at all. And there's no need to really comfort each other with it. It's just about how do we talk to our children about this? I think that's one of the big questions that we're kind of wrestling through right now. And then going from there. And I think that can change, right? Is this the relation? It's going to continue to evolve as Lewis has questions and we tell the story and he wants to know more. And yeah, I suspect that that feeling of being the spectator in the whole thing could kind of come up again at some point. But yeah, Bethany's just been incredible throughout the whole process and has just been the ideal mom. And I'm so grateful for the role she's played in my life and our kids' lives.
You'll come upon some interesting conversations as he and down the road, Iona start to understand or try to understand the various nuances of embryo adoption. I remember talking recently to one of our families. Their twin girls are, I believe, 5 years old right now. So Lewis still has a couple of years to go before he's at that point. Obviously, they don't totally understand it. They do understand that they were adopted and were frozen. And the parents were telling me when they were talking about coming and visiting the NEDC, the girls wanted to make sure they weren't going to come here and get re-frozen. So it does lead to some really interesting conversations sometimes. So strap yourself in, fasten those seatbelts, Derek.
It's great. I can't wait. I'm quite sure it's coming. We've even been kind of working on like a life book and starting working on the describing what this would be like in words that he'll have. And it's been a struggle already. So I know he's going to ask lots of questions about it. And like you said, Iona, when she gets older, so that'll be a fun journey. Yeah.
I love this interview, and I love the point that you have made, this overarching point that parenting is about stewardship and standing in close relationship to this child under God's watchful eye, because they are gifts he has given to us. I really, not that the genetic connection is unimportant for people who are genetically related to their children, but I just don't think it matters that much. I mean, I think of especially my kids, I don't think any of them look like me. And I think especially of my son, who's 6 feet and I'm 5'7". He's not like me at all in terms of personality, looks. And do I care? Does it matter? Not at all. Not at all. He, you know, it's a fit. And so I just think you've done a really good service, brother, in bringing out that point to people. No one should feel inferior, no matter how children have come into their lives. It's a tremendous honor to be entrusted by God to be a steward of these young lives as parents. Hey, before we wrap up, I do want to give you a chance to talk about Lewis House, which is where you're speaking to me from today, this extremely cool ministry that you lead in Lexington, Kentucky. Tell me about it. I think it's the sort of thing people might find interesting.
Sure. Yeah. So it is part of a wider movement called the Christian Studies Center movement. So we're even a part of a larger organization, an umbrella that called the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers. And it's relatively recent. There's been one on the University of Virginia campus for many, many years, but they're really starting to pop up all over the U.S. now. And what it's trying to meet is this need of theological education for students who otherwise won't get it. So we are just off of the University of Kentucky campus in Lexington, and most of the students that we minister to are in engineering or nursing, and they're not going to get any sort of theological education. Often they're not even going to get any really sort of liberal arts education or learning about history of the world or philosophy. Who am I? What is virtue? These sorts of really important questions that used to be a critical part of education, even just a undergraduate education. But it's not so much that way anymore. And so just seeing this need, wondering how can Christian ministries, how can the church as a whole do something about this? And so I think Lewis House, the Christian Studies Center movement, that's one way that we're kind of seeing that need and meeting it. So like I said, we have a house that sits right off campus, and we do all sorts of things. Like we have lecturers come in that are usually Christian academics but talking at an accessible level. So we tell them, when you come in, assume that no one here has theological education, right? You're talking to the average person. And we have a scholars program. We have about 40 scholars. They're undergraduate students. They get $1,000 towards their degree. But as part of that, they do a two-year curriculum track where we're reading books to teach them how to learn to think like a Christian, because we think that the world that we live in, it's important to navigate it with good, clear Christian thinking. And that means something. Like, Christian thinking is a different thing than just thinking in general. And the newest thing that Lewis House has started doing is we offer accredited courses in Christian thought to UK students. So that I taught a class in basic Christian theology, and we're accredited by another local Christian institution. So they technically take classes through that institution, but they take it on UK's campus, essentially, like right off UK's campus in our building. And then all these UK students then transfer that back into their degree. So these UK students who otherwise would have no access to classes on Christianity or theology get classes taught by a Christian professor in Christian theology, and they can count those hours towards their degree at the University of Kentucky. And so those are a few things that we do again, trying to get theological education to people that otherwise wouldn't have access to it. And just the community of people that, you know, they're out there, they're lawyers or doctors or accountants or assistants. They're working in all sorts of different jobs, and having some outlet for thinking like Christians and trying to navigate cultural waters. These are really difficult questions that people struggle with no matter what job you're in. It's not just for the theologians or the pastors. It's for everybody. And so Lewis House is, trying to meet that need here. And I'm great, very grateful to be a part of it.
And you've had some very well-known and influential Christian thinkers in through these lectures. I mean, we're talking about people, if I remember correctly, like N.T. Wright and Russell Moore. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's right. We had N.T. Wright, Carl Truman. Karen Swallow Pryor came last semester as well. And then this next semester, we're going to have Russell Moore. We had James K. Smith this last semester as well. So we do a lecture once a month, and you can find all of those previous lectures online. We were just checked yesterday, and then the N.T. Wright video, which I was able to interview him because I had a relationship with him through my postgraduate work at St. Andrews. So I got to interview him, and it has like 17,000 views or something, the video. So that's definitely gotten out there as well. So yeah, a lot of our videos are available online, and we do a podcast with these speakers as well. So yeah, absolutely. Take advantage of what we've got out there. So hopefully there's some resources for people beyond Lexington.
And of course, it's named after the great C.S. Lewis. And what is the address, the web address for people to go to if they want to check it out?
Yeah, just lewishouse.org.
Yep. Derek, thank you so much for this time. I have loved it. And thank you for the article you wrote for Christianity Today and unpacking it a bit more today here on the Embryo Adoption Podcast. It's been a joy. We're so glad the four of you are part of the NEDC family. Want to thank you all for listening. And if you'd like more information on the National Embryo Donation Center, it is embryodonation.org. Again, embryodonation.org. I'm Mark Mellinger. This has been the Embryo Adoption Podcast.